Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the New Mainstream Podcast,
where we explore the impact of multicultural consumers on marketing and media.
I'm your host, Mario Carrasco, and co-founder of Think Now. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the New Mainstream Podcast. I'm your host, Mario Javier Carrasco, and today we have a phenomenal guest with us, trailblazer in the entrepreneurial world and founder of Suma Wealth. Please welcome Beatriz Acevedo. Beatriz, fantastic to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me on. Always great to see you and love our conversation. So thanks for
coming. Yeah, likewise. I wish I had recorded earlier. We were having some great conversation, but before we dive in, I want to learn all about Suma Wealth, and I know you have an exciting announcement as well. But before we dive in, you have an amazing journey. I know you, we've talked about it, but for those of you, for people listening that may not know about your journey, tell us a little bit about how you became an entrepreneur. This is not your first company, and you weren't even in the entrepreneurial space necessarily before. So tell us a little bit about your journey and how this led you to found Suma Wealth.
Sure. I am a proud border girl. I was born in Tijuana, Mexico. And I always had one foot in Mexico, one foot in the U.S. So I think even though I wasn't a U.S. born Latina, like many people that we serve now in this company and in my previous company, Me Too, I sort of grew up with that, right? The best of both worlds, being born in the border. Like every day you be in both countries and experience the best of both places and sort of form your own mashup identity. So I do give a lot of credit to that for everything that I do. I think my visual aesthetic and everything that I do or even the voice and the tone of the companies that I lead, you could really see that, right? There's that very high pride of my Latinidad and everything that I do mixed with American pop culture and, what's innovative. So I love that. I think that was an amazing gift that I got from my parents, and I'm always very grateful for that. And to have the love of my culture, but also to have the best of both worlds. I started my career really young. I think a lot of people have heard this. I'm going to go very fast because they're like, oh my gosh, if we hear this story once again, we're going to die.
You're tapping into a new audience.
Okay, good. Well, listen, I started my career when I was 8 in radio. I was in love with Ricky Martin. There was a radio show called La Hora Menuda where I started to work at. And my plan was that when Ricky came into my town, Tijuana, they eventually went there. We'd meet and we'd fall in love and, that was my life. That clearly didn't work out. But I did start, I've gone to a job every day since I'm 8, which is crazy. And I was part of the union because in Mexico, anything you do with radio or TV, you have to be a part of the union. So I think I was the youngest member of the union, which was also another very interesting, sort of thing. At 8 years old, my mom would take me to these crazy meetings. So I started like that. I loved radio. I wasn't born with a talent for anything that involved public speaking or being on air talent, although I did it for many, many years. And so my motivation was that to marry Ricky Martin. So I would practice for hours in front of my mirror to be better and, be able to do it. And eventually got this gig and I would ride my bike after school. And fast forward a few years, I started to work in TV. I won a few Emmys, and it was super exciting because nobody had won Emmys in Mexico. And after that, my show went national. This was all local. This is all local Tijuana. And the way I was able to win Emmys is because the signal from Tijuana, you could see it in San Diego and LA just kind of spill over. So we qualified for an Emmy. It was very weird. It was an international Emmy. So then, always in TV and radio and media and entertainment. Eventually, I moved to Mexico City when my show went national. We don't have time for the whole story, but literally, my show was number one rated, everything. And one day, I got fired from the radio station. And it's they hated, I guess, women at the time, who they perceived that had some sort of power or say. So they're like, no, let's cool her off. And that was a thing. They had a ton of women that they pulled off in this imaginary refrigerator. So that's how I became an entrepreneur. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs, you do it by choice or necessity. I always say my entrepreneurial journey was by necessity. So I didn't have money to pay my rent or my credit card or anything. This kind of ties to Sumo Wealth in a way. I was probably 22 years old, thinking that I was literally on top of the world. And I became an entrepreneur, just had to think quick on my feet of like, okay, what am I going to do? So I started to produce these things called electronic press kits, where there are like interviews with celebrities. My first client was Luis Miguel, thank God. And after that, you know, a long list of people. So that's how I sort of like build myself up, started my first company, and then eventually moved to the U.S. because, you know, there was a lot of work here when, you know, every census that comes out, people think this is the time where Latinos are going to take over. And moved to L.A., started to produce a lot of content in English and Spanish and Portuguese. Out of that experience, I felt like, where are all the other Latinos, you know, and there were nowhere to be found. And that broken bridge that today still exists in Hollywood of like, oh, we can't find the talent, and the talent like never is given an opportunity. That was happening 30 years ago. And that's the opportunity we saw to build MeToo, right? Like just have an independent company that was digital media at the time. I mean, it was very, very new, and we wanted to have that representation for Latinos. So that was my whole life in media and entertainment, and that was sort of like my journey becoming an entrepreneur. And after the pandemic, you know, well, after Me Too, I thought, that's it. I'm just going to do my philanthropy. And the pandemic hit, and looking at the data of Latinos being the hardest hit, not just with deaths, but economic hardship, I just thought if anybody could explain furlough in a funny meme, right? Or how to apply for a PPP loan. And really nobody was doing it. Finance tends to be very dry and very intimidating. And that is not a topic that we talk a lot about in our sobremesa with our families at dinner. And we have to, because we all know we're so well represented in numbers. But when it comes to economic power, we're never going to have the power we fully deserve without economic power. So when I was thinking about this, I reached out to you to see if we could, like, you know, you think there's an idea here, Mario, and you're like, all right, let's look at some data. Let's, you know, let's do something together. So I continue to be so, so grateful to you for validating our idea and being like, there's something here, like you should do it. And I was like, all right, let's go. And that's already 3 years ago. And here we are with, you know, a lot of growth and a lot of learnings, but super excited with what we're doing.
Yeah, and we were just talking. I mean, congrats again, and it was great doing, you know, looking at that data, and I can't believe it's been 3 years. But what, like, tell us more about Sumo Wealth. Like, what was the thesis? You hit an amazing milestone, 1 million users. Like, what is getting people to come back?
Yeah. So I have to give, I can't take the credit. The credit goes to one of my co-founders, whose name's Javier Gutierrez. He leads an NHL team, first Latino CEO of an NHL team, which is awesome. And he's a good friend. And when I left MeToo, I was like, listen, I want to raise this fund and, you know, you should anchor it. Because at the time he was at a private equity firm. And he was like, no, that's a horrible idea. Like, you should launch a fintech company. And I thought, no, that's a horrible idea. Like, well, what am I going to be doing as a fintech founder? Like, I know nothing about this. And he was like, no, I think that. So it was really his hypothesis of like, listen, I think fintech companies in general launch product first. Okay. So they're like, oh, I have an idea for a product. They work on it. They put a lot of money. And then they really try to find that product market fit. Is the consumer going to like it? Do they really need it? Is this what they should have built, etc.? And a lot of fintech companies have done incredibly well, right? But not with our community. So for me to say, there's 30,000 fintechs in the US. I'm going to be one more and do the same strategy would have been idiotic, right? So I'm like, I'm not going to do that. So his theory was, don't launch with a product. Launch like community first, right? It's like, you know better than anybody how to build communities at scale, brands at scale that people love. And then, you know, learn from that community, see what they really want, and let that inform like the roadmap to what we're going to build. And I was like, I mean, I guess I could do that first part. So for a long time, I thought maybe I'd come in as founder CEO for a year and then I'll start quickly finding my replacement. So once we get to the financial part, somebody else can take over. And, you know, it was amazing. We were very, very blessed because at that time, fintech companies were the darling of venture capitalists. And, you know, you just said you had a fintech and people threw money at you. And this is 3 years ago. And so we definitely benefited from that. You know, very quickly we raced around. It was oversubscribed. It was amazing. And we did that exactly. We built a community first platform. So what does that mean? That we really already data driven, as you know. So we wanted to really know what, you know, people in our community wanted. So for example, Gen Zs, which there's so many companies that are have built companies for them to pay off student debt, for example, right? That is not top of mind for Gen Zs in our community. Top of mind for Gen Zs in our community, or at least in our community, is to retire early. And that could be a shocker, right? Because I would have never thought to build a product on how to help them start investing to retire early, but that's what they want. And you're like an 18-year-old kid that barely has started working, somehow not even started working, but top of mind is how do I retire late? Like, give me the playbook. So, you know, you are humbled by thinking, by understanding that you don't know as much as you think you do. And it's very, very smart when you do a lot of social listening and testing and learning. And then from that, you inform your product. So what we built at Suma is really a product that is based on the needs that we heard from our community. So in our app, you'll find a financial checkup for people to know where they stand. You know, what does net worth mean? Why is it important? What is debt to income ratio? How do you up your credit score? How do you pay off debt? Paying off debt is a very big trigger for people in our community. Building a good credit score, the same. Buying a home, even, I mean, it's Gen Zs who are Latinos buying the most homes, which is interesting. And maybe it's not a home, maybe it's like a little apartment or whatever it is. But if you look at the composition of all other groups, Latino Gen Zs are driving that. So that's like incredible, but they don't know how to do it. If you tell them how comfortable are you buying something, I don't know, you know, like, but I'll just learn along the way. So any tool and resource that you can provide them with is something that they're really craving. And if you do it in a way that doesn't let them feel intimidated or ashamed that they don't know, better. And if it's in culture and they can get a good laugh out of it while they're learning, even better. And that's something that I think they never found in other fintech companies. So I would say leaning hard into our culture once again in a different company is what makes people come back again. Yes, information is useful and the tools and the calculators and the app and the AI, but everybody has that, right? Like what makes us different is really that, you know, being very proud of our culture and leaning very hard into it. And what's even more interesting is that 30% of our users are not Latinos. And we are very fierce, unapologetically Latinos, right? Like everything we do is like, it's like we want to make sure Latinos feel like they belong. Now, we want to make sure that anybody feels welcomed, and they do, because we have 30% of our users who are not Latinos. And that's incredible. But we definitely wanted Latinos to know this fintech company is built by people like you. We get you. We know where your pain points are. We know, you know, you're probably going to have to take care of your parents financially. We know you never discuss these topics. We know that even though you're college educated, you don't know how to do a budget. We know that you want to die when you don't understand your 401k. So that's why we, or campy in everything we do, we say like 401k, you know, our series is for people who don't get it and it's fine. You can get a laugh, but we'll teach you. So yeah, I think it's that. It's that just like strong community plus Latinidad in everything that we do in the company.
That's amazing. And as you were talking, totally forgot about that side about Gen Z wanting ownership, which makes sense. I'm curious, like you have an interesting insight into a very specific community, a very important community, Latinos, fastest growing, very important economically, culturally, so much so that 30% of your users are not Latino, right?
There's how incredible is that?
Yeah, that's amazing. But one thing I see, this is research we should revisit, because we did research maybe a decade ago on the American dream. And in general, the American dream, this idea was kind of dying. If you look at millennials in general, The only bright spot were Latinos. I wonder now, things haven't, like you mentioned, right? The pandemic haven't happened. Things haven't necessarily improved economically for Latinos. I feel like, I mean, what's the sense you get of your users? Are they like positive optimistically given everything that's going on economically? Like what's the vibe? What's the vibe of the users there? Like, how are they feeling?
I think they feel the same as everybody else in the country. You know, they're scared. I mean, they're just like, you know, this time that we got to live in, especially Gen Zs, right? Like, yeah. Like, oh my God, like, they weren't born into anything that's easy. So I wouldn't say that they're like, oh, we're cruising through life, right? They're very, very concerned about climate change, like very much so. And they're very concerned about their finances too. That's why, you know, the number one thing is like, how do I start now? Like, how do I educate myself now? What can I do? Do you have any tools for me, any tricks, any hacks, anything that you can give me? Because that's definitely top of mind, right? Like, and also, what's very interesting is they don't want the wealth building as other generations as like to be rich, right? But they wanted to like just not have to work at a, not have to compromise their values ever, not have to, including not have to work at a place that they're not aligned with. They value a lot, as you know, life work balance. So it's definitely not about the paycheck. It's like, well, what does this company stand for? And what's my contribution to the world here? And what's, it's a very, very different generation. I mean, even very different than millennials. Although they're so close.
I'm starting to interview and have Gen Z work ethic now. And they're great. They're amazing. I love their honesty. You know, they ask me the hardest questions ever as an interviewer, right? Like, what's your policy on this and that? And that's like, whoa, it's not what you're used to.
Yes.
But I love it.
I love it too. I mean, but it's a very different generation for sure. You know, it's interesting. I was having a conversation the other day at this Hispanic Wealth Building Summit. And they were saying like, well, what you're talking about that, you know, you have to take care of your parents, like, I mean, I'm doing it as a Gen Xer, and then a lot of millennials are going to have to do it. But they're like, but the Gen Zers, they're like, no, they're back at home. They're like, I'm fine here. You know, like we don't need a lot. But then it's like, oh, you were supposed to be that generation. But listen, hopefully we get, you know, the right financial education to the Gen Zers and they can start investing for themselves and for their, you know, older family members. And then that cycle ends there, right? And they give the information to their own kids if they have any. I have a lot of nieces and nephews who are Gen Zs who are like absolutely not having kids because, you know, in 30 years, the planet's going to be unlivable and I can't bring a life into this war. I was like, oh my God, it sounds very doom-like, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. So, I mean, the sense is, no, they're not cruising through life. They're concerned. And finances is something that they're concerned about. And they want to have that education on how to do better sooner rather than later. They don't want to leave it up to chance and just work hard and hope for the best as their grandparents or parents did.
Yeah. And you're tapping into something, right? There's a need there. I know we're recording this late January, but there's some exciting news by the time this is published. It sounds like you've tapped into a really real need there that venture capital and investment has been attracted to. I mean, tell us, you have an announcement, February 6th, that's coming out. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we thankfully closed another round of funding, which in this day and age is not like it was in the past when I was saying, oh my gosh, people would just hand you money like candy. It's been really, really hard to raise capital last year. This year, people say it's going to be even harder. So, you know, with the data, I have everything against me, right? Like, I'm a Latina, I'm an immigrant, I have an accent, because even there is in the data, like if you have an accent. I do have my white passing Latina privilege, I guess. But also I'm older, right? People don't like old. Oh, and I'm not from an Ivy League school. So, you know, kind of have most against me. But it's been really great. You know, we've been able to really curate our cap table, which means who is our investor. We've passed on a lot of deals where we're like, not mission aligned. In that regard, we're like Gen Zers. So, you know, we have, I think, the most diverse cap table of anybody in fintech, which for us, that's something very positive. This round was all our new investors are venture impact funds, which means that, yes, they're venture capitalists, but they also have an impact metric. Like, how are you making your community better? How are you making the world better? Like, how are you tracking the wealth that you're saying you're giving people? How are you tracking that education? So, yes, they want the return and we measure that, but we also measure the impact, and that is by design. We wanted impact venture funds who really, really cared and pushed us to those metrics as well. So we are incredibly proud that those are all our new investors, but also that we are able to, you know, close another round oversubscribed, which means super blessed and privileged. We're able to close more money than we set out to raise. And on an up round, because most companies have flat rounds, which means you have to raise at the same valuation as a year or two or three years back. But that's already lucky. A lot of people have to do it in a down round, which means lower than years ago. That's what we've been seeing. So for us to have raised an up round, an oversubscribed round, and to have passed on investment that wasn't aligned with what we wanted, and be able to only say yes to great humans that believe in us but care about what we're building for our community is just incredible. I mean, you feel the pressure to deliver for them, of course. So you're like the weight on your shoulders, but it's really incredible. So we're very excited. All in, we raised around $5.5 million. And we're, you know, continuing to keep our head down and working to continue to grow the company and continue to
serve. That's amazing. And congratulations on, I think, sharing the importance of having the right partners. It's not just about the money. It's like mission aligned and to be able to do that in this environment, like you said, is an amazing accomplishment.
It's tough. I mean, like, it's easier said than done, because if you're running out of cash and you look at like your run rate, you're like, okay, do I close the company or do I continue to be very mission aligned? So I understand some founders who are like, I'll take any capital, and it's a very tough decision. So, you know, it's not like everybody needs to only be, and in this economic climate, that's why I said we're incredibly lucky, privileged, blessed, whatever you believe in. That we were able to do this, but it's a tough climate.
And what are you, what's the thought there? Like, I feel like there's so many ways you can go with Suma, like community, investing more in that. You already have technology, you mentioned AI. Like, what does this round mean in terms of where you're going to be focusing your efforts?
Definitely technology for this round, right? So, I mean, community, we feel good. We reached 1 million users, which is great across all our platforms. Those are not like TikTok followers or Instagram followers. If you look at our Instagram, it actually has not very few people, like 10,000 out of the million. So very, very small. Also, again, by design, we've just wanted to have a direct relationship with our consumers. We want to have, you know their names or where they are from, what they need, what, you know, how we can support them. And that social is hard to do because, you know, you don't own those platforms. So 90% are on our owned and operated platform. So that's really great. And I think that, you know, so that part on the community, it's set, it's going. We have a good number to continue to test and learn from. And we found product market fit. The tech part is what we want to continue to scale up, particularly because the business model for Suma is a subscription membership. So it's like revenue from subscription. And the subscription gives you that 24-hour coaching on your phone, and it's AI-enabled, the coaching and the insights. You can have a human too for a little bit extra. But, you know, for Gen Zs, less so of a human in need, but as they're bringing their older family members into the platform, and we can talk a little about that later, they definitely, you know, different levels of trust. While as a Gen Z will trust AI, my mother would never trust AI. We definitely want to continue to build that up, and so we can start scaling our membership. And our membership is direct to consumer, but we are also prioritizing enterprise. So we'll sell this membership to big companies who have, you know, large employee bases who are Latinos, or sometimes they want to give it to their customers, which is a lot of the cases of our bank partnerships. So that's where we're highly focused on, just continuing to scale up the tech.
That's exciting. And touching in on a little bit about what you mentioned about, different generations. I think one thing that from your career, that one of my favorite things that you've really evangelized is this idea of the 200 percenter, which I think this is the first time I heard it was at Meet Do, and we actually did some amazing research there that I'm really proud of, because I feel like it's the first time that I heard a phrase that I would like, that I really identified with, you know, as a Mexican American, my parents immigrants. I think growing up as a millennial, you had this idea of, you know, ni de aquí ni de allá, but like that was kind of a negative framing, right? Where 200% was like positive, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so like what, tell us a little bit about what does 200% mean, and how is that we've woven into Sumo Wealth?
Yeah, I think, I learned a lot about that at Mitu, about the 200 percenters, because I'm an immigrant like your parents. So even when we started Mitu, everything was in Spanish. I don't even know if you know that, right? And we were like, you know, we just thought because it's digital, the youth will be attracted to it because it's on YouTube. Because at the time, Facebook didn't even have video. So this is a long time ago. And so we just thought, oh, and then we would look at the analytics and everybody was over 40 and we're like, oh God, what? You know, like, why is this señora wanting to do a smoky eye, you know? And like, we just thought that the topics and the medium were just going to attract, at the time, millennials. And it wasn't cutting it. And we were like, oh no. And we would have these board meetings and be like, well, you said you guys were sort of like, you know, the digital alternative to like Telemundo or Univision or whoever, like you have the same audience here. And we were like, oh my God, this is not that it was bad. I mean, certainly there were people who appreciated the content, but we just couldn't understand why we couldn't connect to the youth. And the moment we switched to English, but in culture, and one of my co-founders at Mitu was like, well, why would we ever do English? Everybody does English. There's going to be nothing different about us. I'm like, yes, there will. Like, it just has to be in the topics. It just needs to be in how we present it. It just has to be, you know, and like, it has to be in English, but it has to be Latino. It's almost like, you know, right? Don't tell me you're Latino and by using Spanish. So that was our challenge, right? Before that challenge existed. And so that's what we sort of call like, okay, in culture, right? Or culturally relevant, or, and it was some, and immediately the moment we switched, and we would continue to do our videos in Spanish, and we would do this like in culture in English and Spanish. And then we look at the analytics. It was like, okay, now we have the 18-year-olds, right? And we're like, oh, wow. But I wasn't that demo, right? I came from Mexico. I spoke Spanish. And even when I came young, like, Spanish was my first language. I didn't think about being a 200%, and I never thought about ni de aquí ni de allá. But we wanted to build this. Then when we started to look at the data, we're like, oh no, we want to build this community that feels this pride. And we got it in the comments all the time. Finally, a brand that gets me. Where have you been all my life? You know, stuff like that. Because, you know, kids in our community have never felt really represented, right? If it's English, if they look into us, it's like the stereotype. If it's in Spanish, you don't feel like it's for you, right? It's for your parents. Like, even the content's just so not for you. Or it wasn't back then. So that's how the whole 200% was like, you don't have to choose, right? You don't have to be one or the other, or neither. Like, you get to be both. You're proud to be a Latino, but you're very proud to be an American as well. So you're not just 100% of something or half and half. You're just 100% Latino, 100% American. And that sort of gives you that mashed up identity or your very unique perspective. I've carried that on everything else I've built. And now at Sumo, we certainly cater to that 200% demographic.
And And I'm curious, have you seen is there a shift in Gen Z? Because I feel like Me Too was somewhat millennial focused. Like, is that 200% idea evolving in any interesting ways that you've seen while your time at Suma, or is there some similar sentiment there, kind of wanting to be?
I feel like it's very similar. It's a very similar sentiment. And we have a lot of Gen Zs working for us, particularly in content. Like, we call them our Gen Zs in residence. And I find that, like, my conversations with them and their ideas and what they care about and what they want to post is very similar to when I had the millennials at Me Too. I think the only thing that we were so baffled about was we did this series with a bank. I won't name the bank. And they really didn't believe that content in English, even though it was in culture, would perform better than Spanish. And so we ran a test on both Spanish, English. And Spanish was head to head with English. And I thought, how could this be? Like, and we never saw that at Me Too. Always English and culture worked, right? Or bilingual.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what to make of it, because I was like, how is this? The data's wrong. I mean, run it again. I mean, are these 50-year-olds watching this? Like, how is this possible? So at some point, I would have answered this question a few weeks back. Like, yeah, I think, like, they're watching more Spanish. Like, I don't know. My hypothesis is that they're sharing it with their older family members, because now we've learned that they're managing up to 3 financial accounts for other family members, and at least 2 tend to be older. Sometimes they share what they learn with a younger sibling. Gen Z.
Wow.
Gen Z. And Gen Z's and millennials too, but I think Gen Z's just have taken more control of their finances. Like, they're just much earlier. They want to understand how to invest, how to buy a home, how do I do this? And so I feel that we're like, oh, maybe it was them sharing with their parents the content. Like, oh, you got to watch this video, and then just playing it again from their recap. Because I was super baffled that English and Spanish were so head-to-head, particularly when it comes to finance. If you had told me it was something regarding, you know, the line Grammy, you know, is music, or it was food, or it was something different, I would have been like, okay. Because, you know, like, they're like, oh, no, but the language of your heart is Spanish, right? Like, when you watch football, like, you're like, oh, you want to hear the long goal in Spanish versus, like, in the English broadcaster. So that passionate connection tends to go back to, like, your DNA for Spanish. But finance, I've never seen it that it would go that way, right? So my hypothesis is that they're just, in the way they manage the financial accounts, they're also sharing the content when available in Spanish, and then that's how it gets to kind of head to head. But I could be wrong.
Are you providing then, based on that research, like, are you gonna start providing everything in
Spanish? Now we are, right? Like, I was like, no. Because at the beginning, I thought, listen, there are a lot of fintech companies targeting Latinos in Spanish. There's very few, like, in Spanglish or in culture. That's a minority. So I just thought, well, listen, I'll let my colleagues from the other fintech companies take on that demo, which is, you know, the older immigrant, etc. And I'll take the younger one. But the younger one is the one who brings in their family members. And they're like, no, but, like, you know, I want my mom to check this out, like, with Bad Bunny, right? Or Peso Pluma, or somebody like, I, you know, like, want her to laugh. I want her to get, you know, via this meme, how she builds her credit. The others tend to be a little bit more serious, right? So they're not that attracted to them. So, yeah, we are now, you know, in parallel, trying to redo everything that we've done in the past in Spanish, and anything new that we do to always have it available in both. Although our audience and our customers are much more the English dom, we do want to give them those tools in Spanish so they don't have the burden to translate.
Yeah. One thing you were talking about, Gen Z being more interested in finances at an earlier age than millennials, that's so interesting, but it makes sense given the environment, you know. And then I think about another statistic about Latinos starting businesses, I mean, specifically Latinas, at a faster rate. Is there anything that Suma Wealth does to support people that want to start businesses, or anything in the pipeline there?
Love it. Love the question. Yes. And we hope that everybody signs on. We're going to launch by Q2, so that should be April, our HEFA Business Bootcamp. And it is a really fun certification. We already have one certification, which is our Dinero Bootcamp, which we do in partnership with Arizona State University. If you complete this bootcamp, you're able to even get a personal finance certificate, which is great for free. And this HEFA Business Bootcamp, we are doing it through a grant from the Wells Fargo Foundation. And that's going to be in English and Spanish. And it's everything you need to start, launch, and grow your business. We're basing it on a book by Ashley Ojeda. She has a middle name that is like Russian that I'm not going to be able to promote. But she has a book called HEFA in Training. And so based on the book, we're developing an animated series with that. You'll be able to, you know, you'll have a workbook to go along. You'll have experts for one-on-ones and office hours. And that is particular for, you know, Latinas wanting to launch or grow or start company. So depends on whatever journey you're at, we'll be able to support you with that.
I love that. I want to ask one more final question. We have an interesting audience mix here. We have people who want to listen about multicultural marketing, research. I think we tapped into a little bit of both, but we also have entrepreneurs. So I think you're somebody I look up to, certainly. I think many other Latino entrepreneurs look up to you. What's a piece of advice that you would give for somebody starting a business? Like what's some advice that you would give?
I mean, for anybody who's been an entrepreneur, as you know, it is not easy, right? So you can never do it just for the money. You know, definitely you're not doing it for the money, because for sure, if you got a job, you probably make more stable income, at least at the beginning. So whatever it is that you do as an entrepreneur, that you really have a really big passion for what you're going to do, because whenever things get tough, like that's going to, you know, people call it your why, or, you know, your mission, whatever it is that really drives you, that you're like, I really, you know, have this fire in me to build this because this is personal for me and I'm incredibly passionate about that. Yes, do that if that's your drive as an entrepreneur. If you're like, oh, I have an idea where I think I can become a millionaire, I'm not really passionate about this, I don't really care, that's going to be tougher, right? Just because being an entrepreneur is really, really hard. It's never a straight line up to success. There's a lot of ups and downs and a lot of uncertainties. Raising capital, like we said, at this time is very hard. 9 out of 10 startups fail. So you're already, you know, we're all in that statistic. And you spend days, nights, when people say, oh, you're your own boss. I'm like, well, I mean, like, you work 18-hour days, right? Being your own boss. So I would say that. I mean, I think the best piece of advice is that you're really doing it to solve for something that's a pain point for you, or has been for somebody very personal. It's that it's personal, that it's close, that you're passionate about it. And then it's worth it, right? If not, it could just feel really, really tough.
No, it's so true. And even when you're passionate about it, right? There's days where
it's still hard. It's still hard. That's what I'm saying. I couldn't even imagine if it was just like, not that, right? Like for me, it's like the idea that, you know, clearly this will be my last startup. I'm already like mid-50s. So I'm like 35 years past my prime of being a startup founder or a tech startup founder. So for me, that this will be my last startup, thinking, wow, like if I can really measure how I contributed to close the wealth gap in some way, that's like, that would have been a great life, you know, work-wise. I mean, I've had an amazing life and I think I've done a lot of good, positive things for my community. And I try to open as many doors as I can every day in every area that I can, not just fintech or media or entrepreneurship. But this seems like a really big task that seems like, oh, wow, like this is amazing. Like if I could really do this. And, you know, there's one girl who went through our boot camp, found us on Instagram, completed the boot camp, started investing. She just wrote a notepad for the LA Times that she's a first-time homebuyer. Her parents didn't even finish elementary school. They were all living in a very small studio with 2 or 3 brothers and sisters. Like, you hear those stories and you're like, oh, and there's this, like, I started teaching my little sister what I learned at Suma. Then my mom and dad had to do a budget. Now my sister and I bought our home. So you're like, what? Like, if you could do that for millions of Latinos, you're like, this is incredible, right? And really game changing for our community, not just now, but for all these generations to come. So that's a big driver and motivation for me.
That's amazing. And I'm going to go look up that story now. And thank you so much.
I'm going to send you a video. I have a video. CBS News did an interview on her. And it's really unbelievable.
That's amazing. And thank you for all you do in the community. And thanks for joining. If people want to learn more about you, Suma Wealth, drop some websites.
Yeah, for sure. For me, I mean, directly to connect, the easiest thing is on LinkedIn. I'm definitely, very active there. I write there. I, post things that we're doing, opportunities, etc. So I would say on a personal level, LinkedIn. I have a website, but it's not like I interact with my own website. It's super easy, beatrizacevedo.com. But I would say LinkedIn is my best one. And then for Suma, sumawealth.com, that's our website, and it has everything, how to download our app, how to go to our Sumaversity. All of our courses and education are always free. We run that through our nonprofit. So definitely encourage anybody to take advantage of that. They're fun, they're easy, they're short, but they're very useful. So I would say, yeah, that would be the best way to connect with Jim. Or anything, like if you're interested in this Jefa Business Bootcamp, there's a link there on our website. Like everything that we're doing, we always promote there. Or on our social, we are Suma on Instagram or on TikTok. If you're more into TikTok. Yeah, that's how you guys can stay plugged in into what we're doing.
Thanks to everyone listening in. To get more multicultural insights, check us out at thinknow.com and follow us on social media. You can also subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform.